Coming to you from fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Chad Wesley Smith and Max Ada.
Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Marvelous Max Montana. How you doing, buddy?
Pretty well. How you guys doing?
And we continue our series of episodes here in Las Vegas, Nevada, joined by John Bros here at Average Bros Gymnasium.
Max Montana, that's a tricky one. I like that.
That's a good one. That's my middle name, you know?
That's his real middle name.
Montana?
Montana, yeah.
Badass.
Yeah.
So, very excited to talk to John today. He's got a great knowledge of weightlifting history. And I think we're in a particularly unique position, having he and Max together, probably almost without a doubt, the two Americans with the most firsthand knowledge of training the legendary, the infamous, more than famous, Bulgarian system. So interested to hear some discussion there, as well as a little bit about John's thoughts on the future of weightlifting, all the changes that the IWF has made. But before we get into any of that, I want to first thank our sponsor, Everyday Squats and Instagram Thoughts, and then get into how John deals very decisively with YouTube commenters. I stumbled upon a Tumblr page called Bros YouTube, and let's just give you a couple examples here. Mike Hawk, he should have a spot. Bros knows why. Does looking like a Dalmatian help you lift more weight?
This is like early 2000s bros roasting people on YouTube.
Dude, that was like my comedy of the day.
It's not a matter of laziness. It's useless to go that low and very dangerous for the knees. True, true. Better yet, don't do them at all. That's not lazy and even safer for the knees. There's a lot more of those. In that you live, I think, every YouTube content creator's dream. How much enjoyment do you get out of just destroying these
people? It was really fun. Like, I would wake up in the morning and I always check. And I had the YouTube channel set where you could filter comments and you had to approve or disprove them. And so it was even more dangerous because you have an opportunity to read them and really think about what you want to say. It's almost like you get to cherry pick and just crush people. But it was actually really interesting because, you know, you'd see people say like the most ridiculous things. And, you know, I don't really care. You know, I have the opinion about life. Like, I don't really care what people think. So if people want to say stupid shit, I'm just going to blast them. Yeah, it's fine. What's interesting about that is you find people would always say things that fit their narrative. You know, there was a quote that says, little men have little minds and live in their little worlds. You know, and they basically are skeptical of anything that doesn't fit their narrative. And it's like anything that's out of the scope of someone's reality is always seems crazy or ludicrous just because it doesn't fit what they believe, because they can't stretch their imagination to believe more. So you'd hear people say, oh, you shouldn't do this, shouldn't do that. And they're like, why? You know, so a lot of the comments I made were very sarcastic and funny, but at the same time, my whole goal was to maybe get those people that are so ridiculous to actually stretch their mind and think, like, why is it not possible? Why can't I do these things? So you try to make it funny along the way, too.
I think a lot of people, if they haven't lived and really been exposed to the world of elite-level athletics, whether that's weightlifting, powerlifting, track and field, the concept of what is possible is a bit skewed for him.
How many people have you come up to you said, I want to be a world champion, and you just go, dude, you have no idea.
Well, for powerlifting, that's a little bit simpler. There's like 17,000 world champions last weekend.
Just show up.
But the idea of trying to be elite level, top of the pyramid of some endeavor, whatever it is, I mean, I don't think people really realize, you know, the amount of effort it takes to get to the top.
You feel like that's it must be, because you feel like that's a thing where the Olympics, you go to some other thing, you go to like, you know, some other endeavor other than weightlifting, and the Olympics doesn't exist for it. There's no Olympics for powerlifting, there's no Olympics for, you know, CrossFit. But in weightlifting, there's this Olympics, and the barrier to entry in weightlifting is a little bit less than something like, you know, obviously something like football or whatever, or CrossFit, where to be really, really good, it's obvious you have to be pretty special to do that. in weightlifting, you're doing a snatch, someone else is doing a snatch. Ilya Ilin's doing a snatch, and you're doing it too. And it, let's say you're a beginner or you're new,
well,
like
you think you're
doing in your
snatch.
Mind, you think you're doing the same thing as him. And so
one
the idea
is doing a snatch, and one's doing like an all caps
yeah.
snatch.
And so like the idea of like, well, like I guess I just have to do what I'm doing now, just like him, but with more weight. And there's this like, there's a trick or there's something that's going to get me there.
Well, then when your snatch doubles in the first 3 months from
yeah.
from 20 to 40.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'll just do that a couple more times and maybe.
Yeah, you're there.
Really
so
got it going.
That barrier in people's minds maybe seems like it's like, oh, yeah, like the Olympics is like a thing that you can just kind of.
It's a huge tease,
do.
Though. I mean,
yeah,
if you think about how
sure.
many people actually go, you know, you send like one person.
Right.
Like the last three Olympics, how many guys we send? One.
I always tell people, too, it's like, it's almost a matter of luck, too, in terms of when you're born, when you start. I mean, like, the Olympics is like this, like, pie in the sky because it's such a unique situation to be able to be eligible to get there, let alone have the talent and ability.
Well, if you just look back at the history of the sport, you know, and you look at how many great athletes that were world champions never even went to the Olympics.
Right, right.
You know, like Pizarenko never went to the Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when they boycott Olympics or something happens, I mean, who knows what could happen? I mean, there's a lot of great lifters that never made it, not to mention all the people that thought they were good enough to go.
Yeah, it's a unique thing. I think that's kind of an interesting aspect of, like, weightlifting with its tie in the Olympics, and people kind of, like, yeah, the total beginners come up and be like, oh, my goal is to train for the Olympics, and, you know,
yeah, if we want, since we're on the subject, maybe we could talk about some of the upcoming changes.
So we've already talked about John's, you know, merciless dispatching of YouTube trolls. But what we want to get into is all these changes. We've talked about this on a few episodes. You know, the changes that the IWF is making to doping control for weightlifting, whether that's a real crackdown or an appearance kind of a crackdown. We've talked at length about positive drug tests and all that. But how do you see... Yeah, these changes, the mandates by the IOC, and the changes to the structure with the weight classes and all that, affecting the future of weightlifting?
Well, there's going to be a lot of massive changes. I mean, a lot. I mean, the IOC, basically what they've said is there's certain weight classes that they don't want to see in the Olympics. I mean, for example, the 94-kilo class had all those retests and so mm-hmm. many positives.
Yeah.
They don't want to see that in the next Olympic Games. So they're probably going to not even allow that weight class to compete. So it was a lot of dialogue between the IWF and the IOC, from what I've heard, about how they're going to do that. Because they can't eliminate a total weight class, because if they do that, it's too big of a jump. So the news that I've heard was the IOC is only going to allow 7 weight classes
yeah.
to participate at the Olympics, but the IWF is still going to have 10. So they're going from 8 now, and currently they're going to raise it to 10. Because when I talked to Attila, I asked him what he thought was an ideal amount of weight class to have in weightlifting. He goes, I think 10 is a good number. Even though in the past, USA Weightlifting and IWF have always mimicked, you know, whatever the IOC mandated, so that way we have a spot for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But now with the IOC shrinking the amount of spots and the potential for athletes, the IWF doesn't want to follow suit this time. So they're going to do something like boxing, where boxing has maybe 15 weight classes, but only 10 are Olympic classes. So it's going to be the same thing for the upcoming 2020 games. There's going to be 7 slots that are going to be Olympic weight classes, but there's going to be 10. So the world championships next year, they're going to announce the new 10 weight classes. So there will be 10 weight classes for weightlifting. So there'll be more people that compete at the worlds, a bigger spectrum, better competition. However, when you get near the Olympics, there's going to be 3 of those classes that are more than likely not going to be Olympic classes.
Now, I don't know if you know this or if anyone, you know, besides maybe Thomas Ion knows this. Are people going to be privied to, like, is it going to be known going into Worlds, like, hey, you three classes are just here for shits and giggles?
Well, I mean, you can still be a world champion.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's, I mean, and there's a lot of strategy to that. I mean, you know, me both know that some people go to meets because they want to win, and some people go because they want competition. So the strategy could be, hey, if I'm in a non-Olympic class, the depth may be shallower there because people want to be in Olympic class, or... you know, vice versa. I mean, who knows how it's going to pan out. But the thing is, leading up to the Olympics, what they've said was they're going to announce the weight classes prior to the World Championships next year, not till the fall. So you're not going to get much notice what the new 10 weight classes are. And then prior to the 2020 games, they're going to announce the 7 that are Olympic classes. Now, excuse me, when they announce those, so people have time to switch if they want to, in or out of those classes, I don't know when that's going to happen. And they haven't even decided what the 10 weight classes are or the subsequent 7 that the IOC is going to use. So they said they're going to basically send a survey to every national governing body in the world and say, okay, what 10 classes do you think they should be? What do you think the new category should be? And they're going to do a survey, and they're going to sit down, they're going to compile all the information and basically choose 10 legitimate classes. Because obviously some of the Asian countries, you know, like some of the smaller classes. And in the United States, I mean, we want a bigger class. You know, some of the other countries don't want 105 is 105 plus. It's a horrible cutoff.
Yeah.
You know, it should be 110, 115, something like that. There's never been a super, you know, to win a world championships weighing 112 kilos. Like, never.
Right.
So, I mean, they're always like Lasha is like 140. The Iranians are 160, 170. So to have like a 120 class or 115 would be great. So,
I think that's a big agreement, I think, with a lot of U.S. coaches is looking for something in that like 105 or, you know, 110, 112, 115 range, right? Because we have so many people that are capable in that category, or that could be potentially.
Yeah, I think it'd be good. So what they do is that by spreading back from 8 to 10,
yeah,
they're going to allow the spread of other weight classes. It's going to be better for international meets. So the Pan Ams will still have 10 classes. You know, all these other international meets will still have 10, just not the Olympics. The Olympics will have 7.
Yeah.
I wonder, though, with this new Olympic qualifying structure that was announced, explained, you know, what, 8, 10 weeks ago now, with it being more of an individual qualification rather than team, how they can go through such a long part of the qualifying process, which will begin at next year's Worlds, without the people knowing which are the Olympic classes. Because if they have to qualify by placing or projected placing within a specific class, how they're going to be able to switch classes later.
Well, they're not going to use it. You have to lift in, I think it was 2 or 3 qualifying meets prior to the Olympic Games, and they're within like 12 to 18 months prior to the Games. So even if they announce those classes today, any meet you compete in now would be irrelevant.
Yeah, and the qualifying process starts at 2018 Worlds.
I don't know if it's going to be that way still.
Okay.
Because what they said is because they're going to do an individual and not a team.
Yeah.
So basically what's going to happen is you as an athlete, if you lifted at the 2019 Worlds, 2019 Asian Championships, and some invitational meet, then you've you know, fulfilled your requirements for your 3 international meets that were drug-tested meets. And if you lifted a certain amount of numbers, then you're eligible. And then it'll be literally up to the country to choose which of they, let's say they have 10 people that are eligible. And at that point, the maximum a country is allowed to send is 4 now.
Yeah.
So then they'll decide out of those 10, which 4 are going to participate.
I was saying, like per that new announcement about the only 4 per country, 1 per weight class, they said that the 2018 Worlds is the first meet within that qualifying window.
Right. Well, when I talked to them, they asked them when they're going to announce the weight classes for the world championships, you know, for the new 10 weight classes. And they said it'll be sometime in the fall, just before Worlds. So it's not a lot of notice, you know. And then I don't know if they're going to announce the 7 weight classes that will be Olympic categories at the same time.
And then
I don't know yet.
At least for that first one, the qualifying process for American, like the way that America does its qualifying when all the weight classes changes. That's going to be clusterfuck is probably the most appropriate term for
that. It's not ideal. I mean, they change the weight classes in 92, and they change them again, 96 or 97?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is not the first time they've changed.
And do you think that part of the changing of weight classes, it's going to be a restructuring of the weight classes in an effort to erase records?
Well, I mean, basically, that's why they did it in 92.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when they changed the weight classes in 92, they said these records are unattainable. They were attained through a means of mass doping where we can't ever reach these numbers. And, you know, so that's when they changed the weight classes. Then in 97, when they rechanged them again, it's because women's weightlifting, they were preparing for the 2000 games, and they were introducing women's weightlifting. So they said, we only have X number of athletes that can go, so we need to condense from 10 to 8 weight classes, which forced a secondary change then from 10 to 8 when they added the women's weight classes.
Right.
And so because of the Olympic structure, they changed again. And now because of the Olympics once again, you know, they're structuring. So because the Olympics is like the pinnacle of our sport, you know, they're going to have to like change based on whatever happens. Do I think it's going to change anything with doping? I don't know. There's some countries that have a culture of that. I don't think it's ever going to change.
Well, the Iranian guy just broke the world record. He didn't need drugs.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, we're good there.
Yeah. I mean, Lasha.
That's the second part of this discussion that we want to get into. Is, you know, the reason that so many of these changes are being made is because the IOC is attempting to punish the IWF. You know, there was 50 some positive drug tests through those retests for weightlifting. You know, guys who were in 11th place were getting to 3rd place through all the retests. And, you know, whether it's Icarus and all that kind of stuff, it seems to go beyond well, we got to make sure we come off the right stuff in time, because we have countries who, Iran never has people testing positive, but they have people lifting world records. Do you think that weightlifting, the IWF, is really interested, especially when you hear news about like Ilya Ilyin potentially returning to weightlifting this year, that they're really interested in cleaning up the sport?
I think the IWF, you know, just like any other, it's a business. And do I think they want to see people lift big weights? Obviously. Do I think they want the sport clean? I think there's some people in the sport that, you know, that are in the hierarchies that do. But there's an old culture still where having drug testing and having people take stuff, there's a method of control within your business. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had a country that dominated your sport, regardless of what your sport or what your business is, how do you make your sport or your business more global if one country dominates? Having the method of where they can, not just to mention the bribes or backhanded deals or whatever, but if you have the ability to test people or let people through, you can actually place people in different countries that can win and make your sport more globally, you know.
Yeah, it's globally appealing. Like
appealing, a, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so it's. I think in some ways they do. And the new era of people are coming up where I think at the end of the day, will the sport eventually be legitimately clean? I think so. You know, because I think the culture is finally going to change in some of these countries where they're going to keep testing people and keep getting people caught. And at some point, I think it's going to be. And I think it's coming around that way. I mean, there's a lot of countries now where there's not just banning of athletes, but I know Italy and Germany, some of these other countries where if you get caught, you actually there's jail time.
Yeah, so Germany is 10-year.
Italy, too. I mean, some of the coaches can get like eight years in jail. The athlete get 2 years in jail. So I know there's other penalties legally, because if you've been deemed positive by this drug testing organization with a drug that's illegal, then legally they're saying, well, you had this legal drug. You tested positive. Mm-hmm. Then obviously you had possession of these things. There's proof. And so now you're facing jail time. So with other consequences that are above sport, that are like, you know, civilly, I think that's going to help change a lot of things too. So I think at some point it would be great if they did and change the culture, and it did.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's you know, today.
To me, what's interesting is, I mean, I think you came from the same kind of place. Like what was really important to me as a lifter, and what was really important as like, was the big numbers and like world records. My coaches, you know, that was the same thing. It was like, who lifts the most is the best. And almost even regardless of in competition. Like if you were the guy who did a 245 clean and jerk in
the '90s,
you're the man. If you're, you know, I don't care if you won the Europeans five times in a row, it don't mean anything. But now it seems like the rules have shifted so much. The way the competition runs, the 1 kilo jumps, and now even without the body weight rule, you're in a situation where
I like that, by the way, a lot.
Yeah, I think it's a great rule. It shifts the competition more to the person who's going to be successful last is the winner. Less so regardless of, or less so important is the guy who can lift way, way more than anyone else, right? It's shifted that way. It doesn't mean it's entirely that way. And obviously if you're 10 kilos ahead, like we saw in the Worlds in the 94s, you're 10 kilos ahead, right? But when you get these tight competitions like that, I think there's the next generation, and maybe the next generation.
It's more exciting to watch
that
as a sport.
Right.
You know, you look at the college football, you know, it comes down to the last play, and everything's
right.
Real exciting. I think, you know, weightlifting is no different. When you have the Pan Ams, for example, and Angelo lifted, you know, Angelo going back and forth and taking silver at the Pan Ams was epic. And then the last guy, he was so far ahead, but people started leaving before he even took his last clean and jerk, just because the competition, in essence, is already over.
Yeah,
like
right.
The excitement is gone.
The battle's done.
I mean, the battle is over. Like, you know, he makes his opener. Okay, he's already won. There's nothing else to see. So at some point, I think you're right. I mean, there are still some weight class, like especially the supers, when you see a guy do something that humans just don't usually do.
Right.
There's still some appeal to a guy snatching 220.
Yeah, we want to see it. Yeah, we want to see a 227 snatch.
Yeah.
But I do think what actually made that session really awesome was less the numbers and more the battle,
action.
Right?
Yeah, the action
in that session was incredible. I mean, we were all there, the fans, just everything about that was really special, and it was just outside of the numbers themselves, which I think is the one saving grace for if the sport, you know.
Well, at the end of the day, it is
a sport. Yeah.
And in sport, there should be competition. And I think that's the thing, that if everyone's more on the same playing field, like not only will it, I think it'd be better, the numbers may not be as high, but I think the depth and the competition will be greater. There'll be more people closer together, be more upsets.
Yeah.
I think it'll be better competition, because now you have these outliers now that are just because they come from a background where the culture is different, or their country's aiding them, or whatever it is. And next thing you know, these guys show up, and everyone else is finished, and they're opening like 10 kilos after everyone's done.
I definitely, as a spectator, you know, whether it was the supers at Worlds, and not only is it great head to head, but it's also world record numbers. Or if we were to look at like the 94 class in the U.S. at Salt Lake City Nationals or Dallas 2015 Nationals, where it was great, you know, 3-4-way head-to-head battles, that was just as exciting. They were chasing American records, which are awesome, and that's great. Would it be cooler if everything was, if it was a 4-way battle at 10 kilos heavier? Yeah, but it's not.
But it's almost irrelevant.
Yeah, it's more about just the head-to-head competition.
I talked to the guy who was in charge of all the network programming for NBC Sports. And I asked him, why don't you put more weightlifting on TV? And he said, you know, people can't relate to how much weight's on the bar. It could be 200 kilos, it could be 10,000 kilos. Like, they don't have any relationship. Yeah. So if you're talking about a 94-kilo guy snatching 170 or snatching 190, to us it's a difference because we've tried it. But to most people, it's irrelevant. They're not even going to ever deadlift that much.
Right.
So the competition's still the competition. When you're rooting for somebody, you still have your favorite, you still have your person you're with. And I don't think your motivation makes that big of a difference. So I think if the drug testing continues to get better and the numbers come down, I think the sport will actually be even more competitive and more exciting to watch, actually.
Yeah.
You know, world records obviously be a lot more rare. But
if you think about something like pole vault, like a different structure to the competition where the weight just keeps going up and basically, you know, you miss it twice or you miss it once or whatever, and you're out.
This is my idea. Max is stealing it.
Well, I mean,
lots of people may have had this idea.
TMCWS.
But, you know, the idea of, like, it's the brinksmanship of pushing a guy to the next thing, and then you're successful, then they have to be successful. That suspense is really cool. But a different style might be kind of interesting.
Last man standing, I think. Instead of worrying about, you know, how much they're ultimately lifting, obviously, because that's the end goal.
Yeah.
I just had to change the format a little bit to make it more interesting so there's more competition. Give somebody, like I had the idea a long time ago, giving somebody one wild card per meet where you can use it for an extra snatch or an extra clean and jerk. You get one wild card, we get a fourth attempt in either one of the two lifts. So that way you can have the potential to maybe get one. You could use it in either attempt. So that way you can, I missed my last snatch. Let me try this one more. If I make it, then it puts me ahead.
I think they'd have to yell, wild card, bitches, and then jump out the back of the van a la Charlie Kelly. If you got the reference, you're welcome.
Yeah. That's a possible.
I mean, there's lots of ideas to make it more exciting. You know, in lieu of having guys attempting world records.
Yeah,
you know, sometimes you see people attempt big weights that are still not that exciting to watch. They still make them look very easy, and you're like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Do you think that Russia can exist, will exist as a country, as a competitor in weightlifting anymore? Like,
do I think so?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have a culture for lifting. There's people that have 5-year college degrees in weightlifting. And so, I mean, the depth of coaching and the love for the sport, I think, is going to continue. You know, will they be as successful and as dominant? I don't know. I mean, you look at their athletes, they have very good technique.
Mm-hmm.
They understand lifting very well. And if the playing field's even, I think they're still going to have people that are going to win. You know, I mean, if you're not on a level playing field, well, there's still other variables involved. But if the playing field being level, and they still have a really great system over there, and they have a lot of great lifters. So I think they'll still be successful.
I guess in part it's kind of like if they're willing to accept the new rules too.
Well, that's another thing too. I mean, there's some people that, you know, are just not going to be a part of it. But then there's, you know, the fact is with the culture and the generation of people coming up, there's going to be people that are still going to want to lift weights.
Yeah.
And they're going to be like, hey, this is how it is now. And you read interviews back in the day where Pizarenko said, you know, if I can't take shit, I'm never going to train. There's no point. And there's that culture of those people. But then there's also the new generation of people that are like, hey, this is what it is.
Yeah.
Let me just be the best I can be, whatever that is.
I was told a great story by Martin through Abajayev that at some point in the time, Bulgaria is kicking Russia's ass. You know, they're going back and forth. And then, you know, like the Russians kind of come to Abajayev and they're kind of like these people kind of meet and secretly, and they're like, hey, like, we got to stop poisoning our athletes. Like, let's just stop taking drugs because we're going to kill everyone. Right. We can't do this.
Armistice.
Yeah. Let's all just agree right now. We're not going to
mutually assured destruction.
So he's like, okay. I agree.
Nothing changed.
The next fucking meet, David Rigger breaks a world record or something. And he's just like, fuck it. Like, you know,
yeah,
you know, they just that I got a great trick. Let's
try
it. That was the last time anyone trusted the Russians.
Yeah, they're going back and they're like, hey, the other guys aren't going to do any now. Let's do even
to
more.
Walk in, to walk in the park at this next meet.
There's a lot more supply out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Yeah, it seemed like this kind of bright glimmer of hope that was coming through with the new announcement right at the end of Worlds there when they had the IWF Congress. And then immediately after that, Ilya starts talking about how he's coming back, and now I'm seeing more articles being posted about like, yeah, like you're in probably, but like not the for sure go ahead.
I got a pretty big debate with one of the guys here at the gym about Ilya coming back, you know, the fact that he's getting a 2-year ban. And it's like, okay, like he tested positive at 2 Olympics.
Yeah.
And you get a 2-year ban. I know, understand that, you know, because of the fact that you have to have some kind of rule, and there's no precedence for something like this, mm-hmm. where they've gone back and flew back in time and tested people in that period of time. But clearly,
for the listeners, just to clarify, Ilya had 2 retroactive positive tests, but they're sort of being treated as
one test.
Yeah. Or
one event.
Yeah, he tested positive for the first time twice, because to have a second positive test, he would have had to have been notified of the first positive test, so then he could have had a second.
Right.
But because they were both retroactive, he didn't know that he had tested positive the first time when he tested positive
so
the second time.
So they treat it as one event.
Yeah, so it's quite a
unique
loophole.
Yeah, because typically if you were to test positive, you get notified. And then, let's say, 3 weeks later, they test you again, and you test positive a second time, they treat it as 2 separate events.
Right.
But you had to be notified and go through the whole process first time, even though his were 4 years apart.
Yeah. And that's like, whether it's 3 weeks
really
apart, 3 years
big.
Apart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So he gets the, you know, the 2-year ban. And I don't know if the Olympics have a separate ruling where if you ever test positive at Olympic Games, you're never allowed back in other Olympics. And I think that might be a separate rule.
Yeah.
Versus, you know,
I think the IOC, it isn't.
I don't think.
And I thought that the IOC had changed rules where if you had ever tested positive at an Olympic event, you're never allowed back to the Olympics again. Now,
right. The
IWF may say, okay, we're going to sanction him 2 years, so he may be eligible to lift at the World Championships again. But I don't think he's going to be eligible to compete at the Olympics again, just basically because of the fact that, you know, to save face, how can they allow him to come back? If they said, you test positive at 2 Olympics, oh, hey, you're back again. Hey, what's up?
Yeah.
You know, it's.
Right.
And would he even want to come back? Because obviously, clearly, his whole career he was taking shit. Would he even want to come back if they know that he's going to be scrutinized and tested severely? Like,
yeah, I guess
what numbers would he do, too?
That's the question. Does Ilya come back and do 172 and 212 as a, you know, a whatever 90-something class exists?
Or does he keep taking stuff and just say, who cares?
Come back and do 245.
Yeah,
because to that effect, I mean, how Lasha's had a positive test.
Well, he served a ban when he was younger.
Yeah, and he's lifting more now than he did.
Well, not only is he lifting more now, he's lifting more than anyone has ever.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at, you know, we were talking earlier about the picture I have of Tarasenko on the wall doing the 266. At that meet in Canberra in 1988, he did 210, 266 for a 476 total, which was the largest total ever. It went down as 475 because of the ruling back then. You had to do an increment to 2.5 kilos, so they didn't count the 66 as total. But in reality, he did a 476 total that day. For Lasha to do 477 at the Worlds this year, that's literally the most a human's ever done in a competition internationally.
Yeah, internationally.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, to do a 477 total. Yeah. So you have to ask yourself, okay, Tarasenko and those guys in the 80s clearly were not drug-free.
It was a free-for-all.
Free-for-all. Yeah. And so for a guy like Lasha, who's already served a 2-year suspension, to come back and do the biggest total ever done by a human being ever, I mean, you have to scratch your head and go, how is this guy such an outlier?
Yeah. It's a similar situation. You know, my background, track and field, the youngest record for the men's throwing events is Randy Barnes' shot put world record from 1991. Everything else is from the 80s. And it's like, well, did everyone forget how to throw in the last in the last 17 years or well,
from
27
the
80, years?
Yeah, so from the 80s. So in the last, like, 30 years, nobody, 40 years, nobody's figured it out.
What's funny is, like, 1988, I don't know if a lot of people know the significance of 1988 being, like, sort of the pinnacle of power sports in the world, because you had so many amazing records there. You had, obviously, all the weightlifting, track and field, the throws.
Yeah, Ben Johnson.
You had the women's 100 and 200 at U.S. Nationals. Ben Johnson. I mean,
yeah, for Spower Sports.
1988 was like, that was the year to be alive.
Yeah, late 80s.
Pants, that's like, mullets were
that's
in.
That's like the late 60s, early 70s for muscle cars. It was like, right. That's the era.
Right, yeah. No one wants a 1981 Trans Am.
All right, so we're going to take another quick break. A lot of interesting stuff coming up in the next year as we learn more about these changes for the structure of weightlifting. Now we're going to hear from one of our sponsors, and we're very thankful for the support of the Jug Life podcast by ZipRecruiter.
Does your business have any New Year's resolutions? Here's an important one every business should consider. Make your hiring process more efficient and effective this year. Let ZipRecruiter help. No one has done a better job of transforming how you find the right talent than they have. ZipRecruiter posts your jobs to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you, it finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/JugLife. That's ZipRecruiter.com/JugLife. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/JugLife.
All right, we're back on the Jug Life podcast, joined by John Burroughs. And so with me today, I have, I would say, the two foremost experts in America on the Bulgarian system, the Bulgarian style of training, the infamous, the notorious, and popularized by Ivan Abjayev, daily, multiple time, daily maximum singles, very, very high specificity. So as listeners will know, Max trained under Steve Goff and then sometime under Abjayev in this style, and John trained under Antonio Krastev, one of the best lifters in Bulgarian history. So kind of tell us about how that came about, and then just your experience training that.
Well, how it came about was, like most athletes, they want to be the best they can be, and so you're always trying to search out the most information you can. And when I was younger, you didn't have the internet. So you're trying to read magazines, trying to find the information you can. And unfortunately, in the United States at that time, everything was handed down from this guy who trained in his garage by this guy's cousin whose brother used to lift weights once upon a time. Mm-hmm. And the information you got was, honestly, it was, to me, it just didn't make sense. I'm very pragmatic in my training, so everything has to be very logical. Everything has to make sense. And when you get conflicting information from different sources that are both, to you, credible, you're like, okay, what do I do? So at one point in my career, I realized, okay, look, I'm running out of time. I only have so much time, to figure this out. And I only have one lifetime. And if I follow somebody blindly and I choose the wrong person, then I'm basically going down a path where I may have regrets later. And when you have people that you both respect, or at the time I had three people in my life, two guys were national champions, and one was my original coach, who had coached the last Olympic champion male from the United States, Chuck Vincey, in 1960. So you have these three sources of information, and all basically give you different information on fundamental things like squatting, for example. Then you have to scratch your head and go, okay, look, like, these guys are speculating how to get to the top of the mountain. These guys have never been there. He has been, but it's a long time ago, and things have changed since then. So I searched out. I tried to find who had the most up-to-date recent information that I could find. And so that's when I saw an article that Krastev was looking for a job in the United States. And at the time, I was working at a gym where we had the ability to hire him as a coach. And so I introduced myself to him, gave him a job. He moved out to Vegas. He lived with me for about 4 months. And then eventually he got a real weightlifting gig, not as a personal trainer in this high-end health club that I worked at, but a real weightlifting gig in Savannah, Georgia. And then from there he went to Minneapolis and worked, trained with Brian Derwin, or worked for Brian Derwin, who at the time was the president of USA Weightlifting, who had a program called the CODP, a local community Olympic development program. And he also had a plan with the Police Athletic League in Minneapolis. And so Brian gave him a job. So then I basically sold my house, my car, and everything here, and I moved to Minneapolis. I stayed in touch with him after he left here. And then we met up in Minneapolis, and I moved there just to train with him. So get the opportunity to learn from somebody who had not speculated on how to get to the top of the mountain, but had been there. I mean, the world record holder and the biggest snatch at the time of all time. Like, okay, this guy, even if he's a horrible communicator, he's been there. So if he can kind of describe how he got there, I'm smart enough where I'll figure it out, versus people standing there looking up at the apex thinking, well, we think this is the right route. He's been there looking down, and he was on the national team for 14 years in arguably, you know, the most successful, you know, weightlifting team ever, you know, with the smallest group of people ever compiled. So if he was in that environment for his whole life and the national team for over a decade and achieved what he achieved, I figured the odds of me becoming better had to be much greater than trying to guess which one of these other guys I thought had the right information, because it also appeared to me that one of these three guys may not even have the right information. Mm-hmm. So why should I pick one of these three routes where it may or may not be the right way when clearly he has a path to the top? So that's how I found him and why I chose to go that way.
It's funny because that's a similar mindset I had when I actually went to train with Abhijeev. And I had a different start because the first guy I got in touch with was, you know, he came from that system, and so that's where I started. And, you know, what Goff did and what Abhijeev did were essentially interchangeable, basically identical. In fact, in some ways, Goff's stuff was just more – it was more aggressive because it was just sort of, like, off the cuff. You know, it was like shoot from the hip, and you don't know, but you're aggressive, and you know that this is what we're going to do. We're going to push everything really hard. But the same mentality was, like, I wanted to find – you know, I wanted the answers – the answer is to, like, you know, is this what I think it is, or is this the answer? Like, what am I getting the actual information from straight from the source when I, you know, made the you know, effort to train with Abhijeev? So it's funny that we had very similar mentalities in going down that route and finding that kind of stuff, you know, or at least pursuing that person, right? You obviously, you know, sold all your stuff and moved there.
You didn't have any.
I didn't have any stuff, but I had to, like, remodel a basement for – like months, like maybe 2 months for like 10, 12 hours a day, digging out a 6 foot basement to like an 8 foot basement with a 5 gallon bucket and a spade.
So you could put the barber head?
Yeah. So you could, no. So I could make the money to go down there and pay to train and live there and stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the things. I'm sure you had the same issue, is trying to find coaches in the United States that actually were qualified. And the problem with this is like, I mean, I think in other countries, there's like a form of meritocracy where people as coaches progress based on what they achieve and what they've produced. And in this country, it wasn't like that. There was coaches that are very popular, even still to this day, are just popular, not because of what they produced, just because they were around first. And I think that's really unfortunate. And that's really unfortunate. It's really unfortunate, yeah. Because yes. Then you're trying to go to these people who are well known and they suck.
Yeah.
And then now you are following blindly these people that get good recommendations because people don't know any better. And you spent your whole life as an athlete, and you suck.
You know, we literally, you know, Chad talks about this a lot, but and it's not to cut anyone down that was there, but at some point in time, someone had to be a national champion, and someone had to be the coach of those national champions.
If you look at the old results, there's like three people in the weight class.
And it's just such a diluted pool.
There's
right?
A lot of medalists in that.
There's people that, like I said, have been around the sport for many, many years, you know, that are terrible. Like, I had one coach come up to me one time. This is kind of a funny story. And he's well-renowned. I don't want to say who it is. But he's been around the sport a really long time. And I was at a meet with a junior lifter that I had. And he was an up-and-coming guy, and he was very talented. And we're at this meet. And he goes, "Yeah, your guy looks pretty good." I go, "Oh, thanks. I appreciate it." And I had a lot of respect for this guy. So for him to say that, I felt really good. He goes, "But you got to be careful, man." And I go, "Of what?" He goes, "His legs." I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Don't let his legs get too strong." And I go, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Because if you use his legs too much, his legs get too strong, then he's going to rely on his legs too much." And so I sat there and paused for a second, and I'm like, "So it's possible to squat too heavy?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah." And so I scratched my head, and then I thought about it. I'm like, "All right, thanks." And I didn't want to, like, you know, like, bash him. I wanted some time to digest because I had a lot of respect for this guy. So I had to think about it for a while, and I was like, "All right, one of two things just happened. Like, one, he's either trolling me because he doesn't want my guy to be good, or two, he's clueless. Either way is unacceptable. The guy's an idiot." So from that point forward, I just missed everything he said after that point. Mm-hmm. Every time I see him now, I just bust his balls. Yeah. Because since that time, I've made it a point to ask every guy who was a world champion in that weight class, "Hey, what's your best squat? How much did you do?" And without question, they've all squatted X number of kilos. And until you get to that number, that's not a conversation to have.
yeah, we talk about this a lot too. Like, how do you know what an expert is, right? Like, and we've talked about this as there's three criteria, right? Which is, have they done it themselves, right? Have they been able to produce this in themselves in some level? Have they had some kind of formal education in this, and real formal education, like, you know, a university or whatever it is, whatever.
It could be informal.
You not say informal, but have they had an actual education?
And then who have they produced?
Right. And then their own, you know, what can they actually do?
Preferably at least two of, you can check at least two of those three boxes off. Because some people just have great genetics and that's why they lifted a lot.
And there's some people that are phenomenal coaches that have never really been in that sport, but just have an eye and the ability to understand.
For sure.
So, I mean, but two of the three of those categories is mandatory.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Especially the last one.
Yeah.
I mean, the latter is, like, the most important. Like, what have you done as a coach?
Yeah.
And if you haven't done anything since 1981, you know, and everybody you've coached since then sucks, like, I mean, you have to ask yourself a question, like, all right, well,
that face should just be that expression should just be a meme.
It's been 40 years, dude.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a huge thing, I think, is that, and I'm sure you see it now. It's probably even worse now, on a sense that it's so easy to just make the claim and title of coach. The internet, you know, we've all seen it, obviously, tenfold now.
Krastev used to call those people killers. He's like, you can't even call them a coach. He goes, all they're doing is hurting people. He goes, they should change their title to killer. They're just hurting people.
Martin and I used to call them professors. The professors. They know everything, but they've never actually done it, right? But, you know, it's an unfortunate scenario where you have that. There's no real way for people to come into the sport, walk in, and look at it and be like, oh, like, this guy's good, that guy's good, because they can say a bunch of stuff, and they maybe even steal things from other people and say, it's mine, it's this, and now I've created this.
I think that's one of the reasons why you and I both, you know, seeked out somebody who had a legitimate resume, because then you can start at the top and you go, okay, Abhijev, clearly, you know, one of the greatest coaches ever. My coach was on that team.
Yeah.
You know, and then even after that, I went to Bulgaria 2 years ago, and I took two of the guys with me that were pretty promising, Marcus and Angelo. We went to Bulgaria, and we spent a month there.
Yeah.
And we got a chance to train with Varbanov and Vanev, Toporov, you know, and Ivanov. And it was great being around those guys, because Krastev was great in the snatch. He was good in the clean and jerk. He was good, but he wasn't great.
Yeah.
And all those guys that I went to spend time with, they were all world record holders in the clean and jerk and not in the snatch. So it was great, because I felt like I was interpreting the system through a second party, through Krastev. And everyone has their biases. And I took everything he said as gospel, which led me to get great results. But there were still some holes in some of the things I had learned. And so by going back and spending time with guys that were in the same system, and how they interpret it was a little bit differently, and how these guys excelled in the clean and jerk and not the snatch, was good, because then I was able to spend time with them and hear some of the things they said. And I can see the similarities in what Krastev had taught me and what I had learned, and I could see the differences. Yeah. And it was interesting to kind of see when these guys were unanimous on one thing that Krastev was opposed on, then I was like, okay, this is clearly why there was a difference in their clean and jerks. You know, and the snatches too. You could see differences and compare notes. So it was really interesting to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's something that's interesting to me too. Is like when you're exposed to, like, I'm sure you had the same thing. When you're exposed to Abhijev, Krastev, you immediately get, like, literally, I remember the first few days was like, you know, kid in a candy store. Like, oh, okay, wow, like everything, we're supposed to do this, this, this. Then Martin pulls me aside. He's like, hey, you're gonna kill yourself. Let me tell you the secret, like the crush. Go. Let me show you how to do this. And you're like, yeah, whatever, that's not it. And then they all start laughing, like, just let him, you know, get broken or whatever. and then you start to realize, like, I like to almost refer to it as, like, the Bulgarian era rather than the Bulgarian system, because there's so many intricacies of what was going on with people and what people did in there. It's like Abhijev's giving out the written program.
That was only a part of it.
Could be put on a napkin.
Yeah, that
and
was
that's
part
not
of
even
it.
Really the important aspect of it.
The environment, the people.
The environment,
You can't, even guys that I talked to, like I've talked to, like I said, four or five of those guys that were in that era. And as time went by, it changed.
Yeah.
Like even in Bulgaria, with everything they knew and they had the same coaches, they still could never achieve the level of success they had during that era.
Yeah.
There was something special about that time with the people they had and the environment they created. And it wasn't so much the training protocol. It was everything.
Martin used to say, and it's so true, he's like, well, you know, when Abhijev was coach, we didn't do any pulls, they didn't do anything else, and they had world champions. When Plamenov-Surukov is coach, they do pulls and they do jerks, and he has world champions. When Yanko Rusev is coach, they do this and they do this and they have world champions. And so I think part of that gets lost where people are, they're so focused on this, what does it say on the paper versus what is really happening in this culture, this community. And the essence of it is the same. I mean, the Bulgarian system has a distinctness to it that's different than other systems, but there's so much more that goes into that that's not the same as there's so much more that goes into that that's not the technical nuts and bolts of the program.
Yeah, like there's a saying one time, you know, success is measured by the glands, the sweat glands.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I mean, at some point people are always looking for this magical program, this mystical system.
Right.
And in reality, it's like a lot of hard work, yeah. Whether you're doing more pulls, more squats, more lifts.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, to duplicate that system they had, and obviously, I mean, you've trained with some of the stuff you've learned. You can't duplicate that era and that system. You don't even try.
It's very different, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, things that I've changed, too, are obviously, like, the scenario you have. Almost everybody I coach, I don't see them on a regular basis. They're all via communication, you know, email or text or phone or whatever. So, you know, the structure of the training has to be different. It has to be a little bit more to the sense that, like, you know they're going to crush go. You know they need to be given more open-ended instruction and things. They need to have more autonomy in what they're doing versus, you know, a system where you're in there every day hammering on somebody day in, day out.
The biggest thing that I noticed is, like, just fundamentally. For example, like, Krastev told me a story where he didn't train for a while, and the police came to his house. And the general for the army the general for the army had to sit there and barter a deal. Like, they wouldn't let him off the team. So Abajayev's whole MO, and I'm sure you've talked to some of the guys in California, like, he would be a dick.
Yeah.
Like, he would just bust people's balls so hardcore, you get him so upset that they would do things. Oh, no, you can't do this. And he would he would just prod people constantly.
He did it to me. I remember, yeah.
Right. But here's the thing. Well. But in an environment like this,
yeah.
where people are coming on their own free will,
yes.
you have to lead with, you know, honey.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
more the carrot than the stick.
Yes.
And the problem is there's a little bit of stick, but more carrot.
Yeah.
And in Abajayev's, there's no carrot.
Yeah.
It's like a
it's
stick.
It's a Kalashnikov.
All the time. Yeah, all the time.
That's a big stick.
Yeah.
He literally said that. Yeah, he was like, if I had a full-grown German Shepherd and a Kalashnikov, I could make you all world record holders.
Exactly. So that was his method of motivating people versus in a free society.
Yeah.
Like, you can't hold people hostage. You can't kidnap their families and be like, oh, you're never eating again. You're like, please come back to the gym tomorrow, and hopefully you'll do well this year. So you have to lead a different way. So just because of that fact alone, you just can't put your foot up people's ass super far.
Yeah.
And if you do, after a while, like, Steve's a tough guy, and I'm sure he put his foot, knee up, high up in your ass a bunch of times. But you're an anomaly. There's not a lot of people that are going to take the type of abuse that are going to show back up the next day.
Let's all just remember, bros referred to me as an anomaly. The parentheses of weightlifting. So
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, as coaching and being around people.
Everyone said that you were the fastest and you had the biggest squat,
but
you were still
lifter.
Bad at lifting.
Terrible lifter.
That does seem like an anomaly.
Yeah. But to come back every day and take that type of abuse for people, and I know how Steve can be.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. I have a lot of respect for him. But finesse is not intact or not words you would use to describe him.
No.
You know, and so the thing about that is you have to be a certain type of individual that has thick skin that's going to come back every day, and people like that don't show up every day, you know.
Well, that's kind of neat that you say that, because I'm sure you've made adjustments to the way you do things as time goes on. Everyone does. What's important is that, I mean, you and I were both coaching at the World Championships. You had an athlete there, I had an athlete there. It shows that there's an ability to adapt to the environment you're given, right? The set of athletes you have, the type of place you have. It's not going to be the same of, like, you know, Krychev. Alex Krychev told us that he thought it was funny that we thought the Bulgarian system was special because in his mind, anybody would succeed in it. He's like, you're just forced to. There's just no other option. You just show up. And you have
if you don't show up, they come get you.
10 people. You're right. Literally, people will drag you to the gym and force you to train hard. And those people all have a vested interest in you doing as good as you possibly can. And so it's like a no-brainer. Like, how could you fail in a system that's literally everyone
pushing even if you're mediocre in that system,
you're going to be as good as you can possibly
be.
Good,
exactly.
Be.
Yeah, I remember hearing stories. There was 90-kilo guys that didn't make the team that were doing – or 100-kilo guys that were doing 200, 240 that didn't make the team because they weren't good enough because there was so much depth from so many people that were just so talented.
Yeah, the numbers were insane. I mean, you know, crazy stuff. There was a guy, Abdiyev told us about, Jordan Dabirev, he had like a shoulder injury, and so all he did was power clean. and he power cleaned 230 kilos is a 90. Probably heavier than that, you know, but I mean, it's like ridiculous numbers, insane things, and maybe they're embellishing, you know, a little bit, but the point is, like, there's a guy who's not even on the team, not going to make the team, no one's going to remember him, but he's being pushed to the absolute limit. So, you know, a lot of that, I think, is interesting in the system and interesting in pointing out that
as coaches, I'm sure you've taken things, you've adapted our training systems, you know, because obviously we can't create that environment because the carrot and the stick method, I mean, we have to use carrots and they use sticks or guns. You know, so we have to adapt, I mean, to basically, you know, do the best we can to motivate people. And, you know, will they ever set world records like those guys back in the day with the testing and the environment? Probably not. But, I mean, they still could be competitive in today's today's world, you know.
Right.
From a standpoint of the structure of the program, with your most elite lifters, let's Angelo Bianco, let's say, what is a significant change that you've made with him compared to what is commonly understood as the Bulgarian system?
Well, so here's the thing. So when I talked to Krasov about guys who are on the national team, they already had to be filtered through, like, the sports schools, through the junior national team to get the national team. By the time the guys were on the national team, and Max would know better than I, that, I mean, I think you remember you telling me a story how Abajev technically was not a good coach.
Yeah.
As far as technique.
Yeah.
That it wasn't until Martin showed you up that he helped with your technique that your lifts improved. So I heard the same thing from Krastev. He said Abajev was not a technical coach. He was a way that could write programs and motivate people because he understood how he wanted to put his foot up your ass. But as far as, like, you know, finite technical things, he wasn't good at that. And he didn't care because it took 10 years before he even got to the national team. So by the time you got there, you had such a phenomenal base that he wasn't fixing anything anyway.
Well, it's were you at the seminar at Waxman's a couple of years ago with Ilya?
Yeah.
And when Ilya told the story about he started training for weightlifting at 6 years old, I would run around the gym and do all the exercises.
Yeah.
And then at 18, he enters into the Bulgarian system. And I think a big mistake that people make with Bulgarian, Sheko, Smolov, whatever it is they think that that's the whole deal, when that's really just the end.
Well, Dimas was the same way. Yeah. Dimas trained with the Russian-based philosophy in Albania, and then when he was already competed at the world level, then he switched to a Bulgarian system when he went to Greece. So it's the same thing. So by the time the Bulgarians would get to the national team, they already have a decade of training under their belt. And so with Angelo, as much progress as he's made, and as far as he made it, you know, winning nationals, you know, second at the Pan Ams, and rumor is that, you know, Jason Lopez tested positive, but it hasn't been announced yet, so he might be Pan Am champ. And the fact that he made the world team within 4 years from the time he first learned how to lift, it's a pretty short window of time.
Yeah.
So during that time, you know, he was going towards more of the Bulgarian thing, which I believe is just basically just getting stronger doing the lifts. But there was a transition where even with him, during the time I've coached him, where there was other accessory lifts he had to do because he had strengths and weaknesses coming from other sports and other backgrounds. And I think that until you build up that base where, you know, somebody has all these things where they're all equal, then you can just work on the list. But most people that come to us, you know, in the first 2, 3, 4 years, you know, they have plus and minuses. They have imbalances you have to address. They've come from other things. You know, if I have kids that are, like, I have an 8-year-old that was here this morning, showed him how to snatch. He figured it out in 5 minutes. And I just have him just work on snatches. I just have him work on snatches and clean and snatch clean jerks and get stronger. I like do squats because that's what he wants to do. So for him, it's different because he wasn't playing football. He wasn't benching like Pat, you know, bench 450 in high school. So now to have him do other stuff, you have to offset some of the strengths you made in some way. You have to balance it out so that way you can be better at lifting. Yeah. You know, so some of those things took years to fix.
There's a lot more general stuff, and then there's a lot more general training involved in it now. What I did, I mean, compared to what I did, was like we had nothing. I mean, and I actually regret some of that, like totally neglecting any kind of. You might not be obvious, but neglecting any kind of, you know, bodybuilding type stuff early in my career and being able to lift big weights and then pushing the things I was good at already in almost like blindly in place of doing things that would have been smarter. You know, if my back was really weak, I should have been training that more. I should have been doing that more than just, you know, trying to build my squat up more and more and more.
So you lean towards your strengths instead of your weaknesses.
And that's just a fault of... A fault of bad choices.
Well, I think it's just human nature. People like to do what they're good at. And how many times people say, hey, what's your least favorite exercise? I hate front squats. Well, today you're front squatting.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
What was the most maximum singles that you have squatted in 1 week?
I have no idea. I can just tell you one story. So there was one time I was training, and I was supposed to snatch a clean and jerk that day, and I was crushed. I tried snatching 50 kilos, man. It was so hard. I just couldn't even wrap my head around snatching that day. It was in the afternoon. I had trained for 3 hours that morning. And Krasov looks at me and he goes, "How do you feel?" I go, "I don't know, man. Like, I don't even have words for how shitty I felt." It was so bad that I remember there was a poster like I had on the wall in the gym that Brian Derwin had, and it was a poster of Krasov doing a jerk, just very similar to that picture of Dragomir. And I remember looking at the picture, and I looked at him, and I looked at the picture, I looked at him, I go, "Is that you?" And he's like, slaps me. He goes, "Of course it's me." Because I was in so much pain and so miserable that I thought, maybe you're not even the guy. Maybe you're just some sick, demented prick that just wants to torture me. You know. So I'm like, so I had to double check to make sure I was following the right person, that I wasn't following some sadist. But so that day I was supposed to snatch a clean and jerk, and I was so beat up, I couldn't even function. So he's like, "All right, today I'm going to be a nice guy." That was his thing. "I'm a nice guy. So today we're just going to squat." Like, okay. And at the time, my best back squat was pretty pathetic. It was like 210 or 215. So I work up to 190, and it was just like it was so hard. And he's like, "Okay." And he was coaching these young kids. He comes back, and he goes, "Okay, do it again." And I do it again, and he's doing something else. He comes back, and he goes, "Okay, again." Well, this went on for 4 hours, right? So I think I squatted 190 that day 50-plus times. I didn't even count. It was for 4 hours, like every few minutes. I don't know how many you would do, but it was a shitload.
Yeah.
And then I go home, and of course I die. And then 3 days later, I squat at 240.
That's a pretty good improvement.
Yeah, so I mean,
that's super compensation, I think, right?
Yeah, so I mean, that was the whole idea of his philosophy is, I mean, you push what you can, you hold back what you can, you know, and there's like a juggling act. Like, I just remember how, like, days how I felt, and if the lifts were looking poor, you know, very poorly, and you just couldn't focus on certain things, he would just push me in another way. But as far as squats go, I mean, that was the one day I remember very specifically where every lift was just heavy. And they didn't get easier, but they didn't get harder. It was just a matter of, like, putting in more work. And for, like, 3 or 4 hours that day, it was just one after another after another.
Yeah.
For people out there watching, listening, you know, have read your articles and all that, and who want to embark on this Bulgarian journey, what is a piece of advice that you would give someone entering into that?
Go to a psychologist, get your head checked.
You'll probably be in the Olympics in how many workouts did it take you to do 40? 4 hours of squats, Olympics.
I just for me, it was always interesting where I had a certain mindset that was always different than a lot of people around me. I'd always see guys in the gym that always be doing partial reps and cheating and doing all these weird things, and I always would always shake my head. I'd always try to find the most difficult way to do an exercise because I figured that if I could master that, then if I were to cheat like them, I could only do more.
Right.
So I always challenge myself to do more, do it the hardest way possible. You know, I had this conversation with Randy Strassman one time about the Iron Mind grippers. Mm-hmm. Like, he asked me, he goes, "Hey, have you ever used a grippers?" I was like, "Yeah, I closed a three." And he goes, "Oh, did you use a deep set?" I go, "I don't even, what does that mean? I mean, I held it like this and I squeezed it," and he started laughing. He goes, "Okay." He goes, "Because people were like preloading and cheating and using this other way." I go, "Why would they do that? Defeats the whole purpose." And he started laughing. He goes, "You and me are going to be friends." Yeah. Because there's some people that have the mindset that they want to challenge themselves. And it was always interesting to me where people would always want to take the path of least resistance in resistance training. I'm like, the irony there was hilarious. So, like, if you're lifting to get stronger, why would you do it where it's easier? Because what's the point of doing it then? So, for me, I always challenge myself to do the most I could. And so I got sidetracked.
You found the right system for it.
Yeah. So for me, for the Bulgarian system, it resonated more with, you know, what I believed already. Like, oh, I want to be the best I can be. Then there's more work. Then this is what just coincides with me. But most people are not looking for that method. So unless you have that mindset, I wouldn't do it. You know, because it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard. It's really hard.
That's
you know.
That's a very honest take on it.
Yeah, I mean it's hard. It's really hard. And you have to be the kind of person that, you know, wants to be very, very, if you're hard on yourself, then life is typically easier on you because you're so hard on yourself. And those type of people, I think, can succeed in anything. I mean, they interviewed one of the girls who won, the Chinese girls who won the Olympics. And they said, "Well, how do you feel about winning?" And she said, I feel confident that no matter what happens in the rest of my life, I can handle anything that comes my way because nothing was as difficult as this. And so it's sort of like, unless you're one of those type of people that embrace that kind of punishment and you really want to see what you're truly capable of, then this is not the system for you. Because you are going to fail. But failure doesn't define you. It's not a person. It's an event. And if you're the kind of person that can and enjoy that and challenge yourself to be better, then it's for you. Like, some people, you give them a puzzle, and they'll like, ooh, this is hard. I enjoy this. Some people go, oh, just I'd rather do the easy one and just do more of them. So it just depends on the type of person you are. But you just have to be honest with yourself, because if you think that you're not the type of person, you try a system like this, you're going to be sitting in the outside crying, and you're going to be like, this is really hard. I can't do this. And you're just, they're going to walk away and never do it again. So, I mean, you have to really, I think, you have to self-analyze a little bit before you choose to go down that path.
Self-analyze slash self-loathe.
For some people.
You kind of have to hate yourself.
Well, I think that's a good episode. I think we're... Yeah. Plus, if we keep talking, it's going to be like a two-and-a-half-hour long episode.
So,
I don't get you guys out to Vegas too often, so.
Yeah.
So we'll wrap that up here. That was another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. John, thank you so much for,
thanks
for joining
us.
Thanks
for having me.
If you enjoy the Jug Life, make sure to go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us something funny or nice, and maybe we'll read it on the air. Like this person, ZRA Cow. There might be another way to say that. Chad and Max are some of the smartest people in the strength industry. Well, thank you. And have proven that they know what they're doing. Debatable. They're also a bunch of goofballs who love 80s action movies and great comedies. With that combo, I don't know why they aren't number one on the charts. Keep up the good work. I don't know why we're not number one on the charts either. But if more of you go and give us 5-star reviews, more people will find us and we'll be closer to number one. Upcoming events this weekend, Saturday, February 10th. Episode won't come out for a little bit. Max and I will be in Reno at Black Iron Gym. Max and American record holder Kiana Welch, along with Team Juggernaut lifter Alexandra LaChance, will be putting on a little snatch clinic for free, and then we'll record a live episode of The Jug Life. After that, next weekend, Max will be in the Netherlands at CrossFit Stark. I will be in Chicago at Midwest Strength and Performance.
I'll be here.
John will be here in Las Vegas, probably squatting. After that, Marissa and I are headed to Australia. So if you're in Brisbane, Canberra, or Melbourne, we will be there. A couple different types of clinics. And then beyond that, we have Jug Life Lives coming up in New York on March 23rd at JDI Barbell and March 24th at Outlift Athletics. So visit store.jtsstrength.com under the events section to learn more about all of those. We're always proud of the content we produce here on YouTube. 3 videos a week from the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. So every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, join us for a new video. If you're interested in online coaching for powerlifting and weightlifting, Super Total, which is the unholy combination of the two, or the new powerbuilding program by Marissa Inda, visit juggernautcoaching.com. You can find The Jug Life on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and thejuglife.com. John, where can they find you on social media and all those websites and whatnot?
Basically, Average Bros. We have AverageBros.com is our website.
With a Z.
Z. That's my last name. People always think Average Bros, and it's like they think it's like, what's up, bro?
Yeah.
But it is my name, so it's with a Z. AverageBros.com on Instagram and Facebook and our website, AverageBros.com.
Do you have a rivalry with the Las Vegas Athletic Club similar to a Globo Gym Average Joe's scenario?
I never told you a story how we came up with the name in the first place.
It's not based on the movie Dodgeball.
Well, sort of. Dodgeball was based in Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And so at the time we had a competition in Global High Schools here in town. And we had guys lifting at my gym, so it was our gym versus Global High School. So, so we should have like Average Bros, because my last name, versus Global High School. And it was pretty funny, so that's how we came up with the name. So it was
nice.
That was a cool spin.
The Global High School Purple Cobras. Max, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram, Max_Ada, or on Facebook.
And you can also email him at max@jtsstrength.com if you're interested in online coaching.
That's true. Get that part.
Wrap-ups are never his strong suit. I'm Chad Wesley Smith at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your newsfeed all day. This was the Jug Life Podcast. Thanks for watching and or listening. I wonder if there's anyone who just watches but doesn't listen.
Go ahead and leave a comment. Maybe we'll let John respond to it on
YouTube. That'd be good. I look forward to it.
All right. See you next week.